Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Michael J. Henry, who reads from and discusses his new book, No Stranger Than My Own, published by Ghost Road Press. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. Tonight is the final reading of 2008. We're honored to have Michael Henry here. So Michael is here to read from No Stranger Than My Own. It's a fantastic book of poetry. I'm thinking most of you already know him, so I'm not going to really talk a whole lot about who he is and everything. I am going to say one thing, though. I think that Michael's poetry is very distinctive. Last Thursday, I was on the bus on the 402 Limited going to Highlands Ranch, just reading the all the signs up there, and there was one for Poetry in Motion, and I read the poem called The Facts of Running, and I was like, gosh, that sounds just like Michael's. And it was. I didn't even read the author. So it's a good reason to ride the bus. Keep trying different buses to see if you can see his poetry. So, and without any further ado, here's Michael.
Thanks, Joe. Wow, I'm at the Tattered Cover. This is really weird. When I first found out I was going to get a book published, my first thought, besides like, oh my God, people are going to actually finally maybe read my writing. That was a scary thought in itself. The second thought I had was, I'm going to get to read at the Tattered Cover. This is pretty cool. And it's really great that Joe did that wonderful introduction, because Joe was a longtime poetry student of mine in the late 90s, when before Andrew and I were married, and when we taught all of our classes together in our loft in downtown Denver overlooking the Greyhound bus station, which was always something interesting going on there. So it's great to be here. Thanks, Joe, for the introduction. Thanks, Tattered Cover, for having me as the last reader. That's really, is that a good thing? I don't know. I just want to thank a few other people before I read. Definitely want to thank Charles Stillwagon for the Tattered Cover. He's always been a champion of Lighthouse from, you know, the time we first moved here and started Lighthouse Writers. He's always been really nice. He calls us back. He emails us back. It's really a nice thing. And, you know, he didn't know us from anybody, and, you know, we would ask him, like, can we come and do a free talk? And he'd say, sure, come on down. And I remember one we did, I was on writing your life story, kind of like writing memoir, and it ended up being in the Post, and everything. It was a free talk, and this is when we were trying to get Lighthouse started. And we set up, like, 15 chairs in the back there in a little circle, and the chairs filled up, and then more people showed up, and we put out more chairs, and then more people showed up. And this was in the midst of doing introductions. Every person got to go around and say who they were and what they were working on. It turned out there were like 75 people showed up. So most of the hour and a half was spent people introducing themselves. I would also like to thank Ghost Road Press. I think what they do is just absolutely wonderful, especially Sonia Unrein and Matt Davis for first accepting the manuscript and then for making a book that I'm really proud of. I also want to thank just my writer friends and fellow teachers, people like Eli Gottlieb, who is not here tonight, but he blurbed the book. Bill Henderson, who is a good friend and always gives really great advice about writing. Also, Jenny Vacchiano. Where are you, Jenny? There you are. Jenny Vacchiano, ITEL, sorry. Who we've known since graduate school. I took a workshop with Jenny before I met Andrea. So you've seen these poems. You're probably the oldest That didn't come out right. You're the first person to see some of these poems. And certainly I want to thank Chris Rancic, who's not here. He's the Denver Poet Laureate, and he helped me put the manuscript together because I had no idea what I was doing. It's, you know, and I shouldn't say that as a teacher because I tell people what to do and act like I know what I'm doing, and then when I have to do it, I get scared. I just also want to say thanks to all the students I've pretty much ever had. You guys always inspire me with your love for writing poetry and just your curiosity about the craft and your open-mindedness and your hopefulness about it. I think I took a kind of a sabbatical from teaching poetry for a while, and then once the book was about to come out, I started teaching again. And it was just great to get back into it again and have those students who they teach me so much every single day. And last but not least, of course, I really need to thank Andrea Dupree. Some of you, do you know her? Have you met her? Without her, I would, I always joke, I would be living in my hometown, which is a suburb of Buffalo, New York, called Cheektowaga, which is an Iroquois word for land of the crabapple trees. It's a very, very beautiful town. But if I had met her, I'd probably be working at a 7-Eleven there and living in a flat above a liquor store. So Bill Henderson says that she's his muse, but she's certainly my muse. So thank you, Andrea. Okay, so to get started, I wanted to read a poem, not mine, but from somebody else. His name is Thomas Lux, and he's a favorite poet of mine. And I'm going to give you guys a choice. You can vote. I'd like to read either a poem called An Horatian Notion or I Love You, Sweatheart. Sweatheart? Oh. I'll read, if we go out tonight, I'll read An Horatian. Okay, I'll read I Love You, Sweatheart. So Thomas Lux, he went to undergraduate school at Emerson College, which is where I went and where Jay Leno went and Henry Winkler and Dennis Leary and, who's Stephen Wright? And he became a poet, and we had the same teacher. His name was Bill Knott, who was just a very weird guy. So anyways, to make a long story short, Thomas Lux, I went to a reading of his, and he read this poem, and he prefaced it with, I can't remember what it was. What was the story? I don't want to give it away. It's sort of like a joke. You don't want to give the punchline away. You'll get it. Thank you. See, I'm so glad she's sitting in the front row. I Love You, Sweatheart by Thomas Lux. A man risked his life to write the words. A man hung upside down, an idiot friend holding his legs, with spray paint to write the words on a girder 50 feet above a highway. And his beloved the next morning driving to work? His words are not meant to be so unique. Does she recognize his handwriting? Does he hint to her at her doorstep the night before of something special, darling, tomorrow? And did he call her at work expecting her to faint with delight at his celebration of her, his passion, his risk? She will know I love her now. The world will know my love for her. A man risked his life to write the words. Love is like this at the bone, we hope. Love is like this, sweatheart, all sore and dumb and dangerous, ignited, blessed, always, regardless, no exceptions, always in blazing matters like these, blessed. Thanks. All right, I'll read some of my poems. And I guess I'll take questions, comments, or concerns that you may have when I'm finished. And you don't need to clap after every single poem. I know you're going to want to, but so you can either do the sort of the poetic thing, go, oh, or the huh. The huh is good. Or if you need to fall on the ground and speak in tongues after the poem, that's fine. Whatever you want to do. All right, so let's see. Andrea, I wrote a list, and then Andrea marked it up, and she said you should read these poems instead, which I do really, really appreciate. Did you want me to read Tomatoes? No, you didn't, did you?
I did.
Oh. Well, that's right, Giacomini first. Sure, yeah. whatever you need to do, that's fine. Giacometti. Once she sent me a postcard of Giacometti walking past one of his statues. Body tilted forward, hair out of place, sinewy limbs like the bronze figure beside him. Art mirrors life, she says, and sometimes it gets warped. She has soft gold hair on the back of her sloping, gentle neck. She says she comes every time we make love, a sharp tug on a string up and tingling her back. I never believed her, but then I read a feature in Esquire that supported what she said, so now I believe her. We play a game where I say simple things and she answers with a word, like locker, shower, fingers. Her reply, photograph, secrets, lemons. Walking through the med center near school, we got lost once. Went down the wrong hallway, came upon a solitary waiting gurney. She loved the gentle folds of the blue velvet body bag, the yellow script on the side, Monroe County Coroner's Office, stitched just below the zipper. The body inside must have been thin and not too tall. I did and did not want to touch it just to feel the velvet. She wanted to pry open the zipper and see the face, feel the cold skin of death. I whispered, sky, cloth, wheel, nails. She answered, touch, stitch, slashed, file. We began walking, hunched forward as we left the velvet body. She said the face would have been made of bronze, gold and shimmering, like a priceless statue. The next one I'm going to read is called Albany Winter, and it's based on imagining what happens at the end of John Cheever's short story, The Swimmer, where Nettie Merrill kind of comes to the house he finds, and he doesn't live there anymore, and the house is all boarded up. In the foyer closet by the staircase, he finds a silk scarf, smells the lingering sweetness, tangerine and cream, his dry fingertips snagging the soft weave. He ponders the call of a bullfrog by the backyard pool, cannot believe it's gone, all of it. Nothing left except dust on windowsills, a lonely white scarf. He blames himself. He coveted too much for it to be good. She is far away, the kids dispersed to distant gray cities, the house incredibly empty. And he can see a time, years from now, when he'll be old and so in love with this moment that I'll have to get up from the table and make tea, whiskey or vodka, too harsh. He'll sip hot sweetness from an old mug, listen to his grandfather's cabin creak on a raw, cold night. Only then will he love this moment, when he is old and alone and lonely, the scarf against his face, bitterness on his tongue, the taste of emptiness. The wind will stamp outside, night falling in a small window, winter, the fields golden and dead, just outside Albany, in the old house with gravestones down back by the creek, in the shadow of a dormant willow, his family name eroded, but the strange skulls and wings of death still clear, still indelible. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So it's sort of a weird thing to get a first book of poetry published. It's kind of a, I tell people, it's like your earliest, greatest hits, because usually a long period of time comes out and you're just writing and writing and you're throwing bad poems away and trying to keep good poems in. And so the manuscript just becomes a layering of stuff that, you know, doesn't make you sick to read. It encompasses a lot of time, but also encompasses a lot of styles. Some of these I wrote in graduate school. Some of these I wrote probably about a year ago. So it's sort of weird. This is an old one. It's a prose poem. It's called The Apple. And It's all true. My hand is out in front of me, a large red apple balanced on my palm. I am with my dad. He's 20 yards away loading his rifle, and I'm not nervous. He's a good shot, has perfect vision and calm hands. He's a surgeon, never drinks, likes to hunt for the sport, but always brings the meat home. So in the basement freezer chest, there's antelope in a neat stack, venison in another stack, an icy globe of woodchuck in plastic and tinfoil, a gift from Grandpa. Each white packet is labeled with the name of the animal, the date it was frozen. My arm is tired, but I will not move. He puts on yellow shooting glasses, raises the gun to his neck, then stares at me for about 10 seconds before he looks through the sight. We are parallel statues. I can feel the tall grass tickling my legs, the buffalo grass under the pine trees bordering our lot. I keep my arm out, palm up, fingers flat. The apple is perfect and shiny, and oh, how much would I like to put it to my lips, to bite and taste it, to satisfy my desire for it. And just as I begin to lose myself in the imaginary juicy chewing of the ripe sweet apple, there is a loud crack and the orb grazes across my hand like a rope pulling through my fingers. And then it's gone, shattered across the grass, yellow inside splayed about, a meal for birds. I look back. My dad lowers the gun. He pulls off his glasses and says, "Good job." Okay, so it's not true. I lied. That really did not happen. And since Andrea sent out an email today begging people to come, and she mentioned that I would talk about Elvis, I have to read a poem about Elvis. So this is actually a multi-part poem, and I'm not going to read all the parts. I'm just going to read the first and last part. It's called Elvis Ideal. Photograph. He's on the floor, everyone gawking as if he's tripped or fainted, anguish in everyone's hips, in their lips slightly open, mouths deep, black circles. Camera bulbs are about to flash. All the women are standing, hands by their faces, probably trembling or held up to praise Jesus for letting them see him. See the soles of his shoes, the way his head dips from his shoulders, caressing the microphone with sweet puckered lips. Everyone in the theater leans toward him like shavings of steel toward a magnet. Does he think of them as he crawls across the dusty stage, hard wood pain in his elbows and knees? Does he hear them, or is he one with the music, unaware of the storm he makes, those pulled crazy by the voice singing through his body? That's part one. I'll read the last part. Actually, I'll read the last two. The second last is really short. It's called Time. I have an Elvis wall clock, numbers on his chest and chin, hands open at his sides, mouth open in mid-song, legs and hips swinging, a pendulum in perfect time. Last part's called Together. January 8th. Does everybody know what that date is? Yes, the day he died. No, his birthday is August 15th. January 8th. By the way, Graceland is the second most visited house in the United States. You know what number one is? The Farrell House. Yeah, there you go. Excellent. Very good. She's good. Together. January 8th. My wife and I tune to Elvis 101, a station playing The King all day. We listen to In the Ghetto, and she laughs. We listen to Suspicious Minds, and I am sad, too sad. All day it goes like this. We only speak when it's important to make a flip comment or tell a story about something. It grows dark. The day has slid by. When they play All Shook Up a fifth time, we turn the radio off. I sit on the couch looking at the faces of the tall buildings outside our downtown loft, their endless cubes of light. I pray someone is in there dusting. And now I'm going to read Tomatoes, just for Greg Hoyle. He said he brought some tomatoes to throw at me. You didn't quite say that. It was sort of something like that. Tomatoes. I'm a poet. I have to talk about the poem, like, you know, before I read the poem, you know. So before, in our poetry workshop, we do a 10-minute free write when we get together just to kind of get warmed up. And I usually randomly pick a prompt, sometimes really randomly, sometimes less randomly. And this poem actually came from a free write that I did in class. And the prompt was, I'm on a parapet looking down. Tomatoes. I'm on a parapet looking down at upturned faces and voices rising like feathers in an updraft. I am afraid of heights, but I know I will fall. And in the knowing, my fear is singed. My will is a skeleton bound by silver twine. On my cold wrists, there are bracelets, inlaid turquoise with silver hammered thin by a Hopi in Arizona, a boy whose face is wide and soft, who blinks each time the small hammer strikes. I once had a girl, once lived in the gray cosmos of her cigarette smoke, her dark paneled room, her gold brown eyes and face so finely wrought like porcelain. The way she brushed her hair down across her scapula and vertebrae left me weak. I thought I might turn to a feather and drift away. She had a friend whose name was Paige, who had a mother who did away with herself on the summer solstice, 4 bottles of pills while sitting in a chaise lounge by a thicket of tomato vines, overgrown and unkempt, the red planet so heavy and full. And Paige said every day that August she ate them with a pinch of salt. She said they tasted like nothing, nothing at all, like air, she said. This next one I definitely wrote in graduate school. You probably workshopped this, Jenny, like 15 years ago. So it's old. It's called Ned Falls. Trapped at swim team practice, I blossom under fluorescent lights. I guess it's dedicated to, what's his name? Michael Phelps. Yeah, that's it. I forgot his name. Michael Phelps Falls. I'm going to change the title. Trapped at swim team practice, I blossom under fluorescent lights. My fingers are wrinkled carrots waiting to be peeled. My toes are webbed. The water is cold and greenish. The natatorium is musty and chlorinated. My eyes want to be rubbed as Ned dives in with a loud splash, but no spray. I hear his body warp under the waves. Ned's our star. My fingers are pencils pointing out his taut shoulders. My shoulders are rounded like the glass paperweight Mr. Kowalski, our algebra teacher, keeps on his desk. Inside, a frozen scorpion curls to strike. Ned can faint on command, spilling his books across the floor, his body splayed out, eyes vacant, tongue rolling between his lips like an overheated dog. After practice, the open sky will drown out all except the cawing blackbirds who school in trees. Ned will climb to the top branches, conversing with crows, his skin growing feathers, his fingers scraping talons. When the season begins, Ned will swim fast as a manta ray. He'll be a terse racer. Water will bloom over the guttered sides onto the deck, sticky with the growth of mossy germs. Ned believes in mens sana and corpora sana. Yesterday, the diving board tripped Ned, throwing him in. He looked dead under the ripples, but I knew he was just holding his breath. Want to hear a couple more? Okay. How long have I been reading? I have no clue. Everybody's awake, so I guess that's a good sign. Should I take that as a sign? Keep reading. All right. Let's see. All right, here's an Andrea request. She picked a lot of old ones. Did you know that?
Which one is that?
The Far Badlands.
Oh, I like that.
Okay. Okay, sure. I'm a sucker for Andrea. It has an epigraph. It's called The Far Badlands. It has an epigraph by Mark Strand, one of my favorite poets. And it goes like this. In that solitude of soundless things, in the random company of the wind, to be weightless, nameless. Here the wind has no trees to make it sing. It hushes onward, a low hovering sigh. Hiking from the dirt road, I avoid trails and campsites, my steps sinking into dry earth, sometimes sliding crab-like down steep faces on heels and hands, tearing off a skin of crumbled dirt. An hour of travel and there is no one. This is what I came for, to be alone, my face unseen, voice silent. In the midst of the Badlands, there is nothing to hear but the wind gliding past like a snake. On a distant plateau, buffalo stand still, become statues. Watching them, my walking becomes an enigma. I'm nothing but footsteps in a crooked line, soon to be washed away by the careless grind of wind and rainwater. When dusk comes, I set up camp, sit cross-legged as the sun blazes the western rim of sky. Every second the cloud's purple deepens, chameleons of sunset. In this open space, I know the day's failing glow, the sweep of my watch's second hand. In this open air, stars pierce through to form mythic heroes and creatures as the Badlands fade away, and then I sleep. Before dawn, I strike camp. The wind rests. I walk slow, unable to sense direction, walled in by a swirling maze of dry stream beds and spires of rock capped by tufts of sagebrush. I come up and over a small hill. A herd of mule deer freeze, all eyes on me. Another step and they bound away, white tails raised. When I reach the overlook parking lot and open the car door, there's my face dimly in the window. Seconds later, the sun breaks the horizon and warms the world. In Cedar Pass, just outside the gates of the park, an old Sioux in a faded jean jacket slouches in a folding chair, gray hair cascading over his shoulders. He, too, looks for my face as I pump the gas. I should have marked these. I really should have marked these. You know? It's funny how you look at people like, God, they have all these little marks on them. Now you realize that's a good idea. Table of contents. Okay. You'd think I would know this backwards and forwards, but I don't. All right. Page 61. Here's another oldie. I'm just full of old stuff tonight. This, you'll remember. I'm just going to talk to Jenny like she's the only person here. We were in a workshop with the poet Gail Mazur, and she was getting frustrated with us, so she was like, I'm going to give you guys an exercise. I want you to read Elizabeth Bishop's In the Waiting Room, and I want you to write a poem just like that. So this is the poem about being kind of stuck somewhere, and there's sort of a transformation that occurs, but it's a very muted one, sort of, yeah. Thruway Mall Atrium, 1980. I shuffle my brown clogs against the astroturf risers as Mr. Vogel mouths out the title of our next song, In the Mood. It is February. The mall is scattered with old couples and a few parents. The Cleveland Hill High School stage band entertains shoppers, an afternoon of jazz and swing. I'm second chair trombone, even though I sometimes fake playing the notes when they come too fast. throwing the slide back and forth. I think I look good without sounding bad. But in the mood is easy, and I shift my arms smoothly, a confident 14-year-old, pulling and pushing the slide, lips pressed against the silver mouthpiece. The band's in sync, and Mr. Vogel allows himself a smile for the small crowd near a stand of plastic ferns. Ron Lyon's parents are there. He's first trombone, has a rich, silky aura that flows from his gleaming cone trombone. And then, by the penny-filled water fountain, I see my father in his post office uniform. In the light of the plexiglass atrium, I notice his sandy blonde mustache, something I've taken for granted. He's had it so long. He waves shyly, adjusting his empty mailbag. His eyes don't seem tired in this light, though he's been sleeping on the couch since August. I've never seen his face while I play. I practice in the basement so he can hear Dan Rather. Yet there he is, my only witness. By next September, I'll outgrow these brown clogs and quit Mr. Vogel's stage band. Before that, my father will move to an apartment 3 blocks from the mall. He'll sleep alone in a small room. He'll eat off paper plates. During Ron's solo, a smooth melodic swing, I count out the measures and smile at my father, whose face, different now, smiles back. Thanks. Does that mean you like that, or you want me to be done? I'll read, let's see. Read one more?
Two more.
Okay, sure, twist my arm. Let's see. Well, since you seem to like the autobiographical, sort of, I'll read another one. Cadillac, an ode. Sphinx-like, it rests in the driveway, a cherry-red convertible, red leather seats, white canvas top, shining chrome line down the center of the hood, the insignia a family shield with fern leaves curled, the hubcaps 100 gleaming spokes, fat white walls, the engine a furnace block hunk of steel, a 28-gallon gas tank tucked under a trunk which could fit 3 dead guys, a hyperbole of luggage, a cooler packed with northern Pike, or my grandfather's shotguns in custom leather cases. It's a 1968 Coupe de Ville, gift from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Local 449. We get in and he drives into the bright Buffalo sunset. Every poem I've written has the word Buffalo in it. Bright Buffalo sunset, and beyond the break wall, Lake Erie shudders blue-gray as he reaches down for the CB radio, which looks like a phone, as the engine tracks the press of his foot, urges the long red boat headlong, thrumming and floating on the road, my grandfather's meaty left hand, middle finger cut off at the last knuckle, a smooth stub, light on the steering wheel, ring of red so delicate and thin. Okay, so the last poem I'll read tonight is probably one of the most recent poems. You'll obviously notice that I wrote a lot about childhood, and it was, in fact, it was actually, I mean, having kids in a million ways is a wonderful thing, but as a writer, having kids is actually kind of nice because you have your perspective changes. So instead of writing about being a kid, you write about being a parent who has kids, and that's been really kind of a wonderful experience because they say the craziest things. trying to think of some good ones. Well, our almost 5-year-old, the other day, I was driving her to school, and she said, I have a question for you. And I said, sure. And she said, how can we talk if we're made of meat? Yeah. I didn't really have an answer for it. And then, of course, the older one, in lieu of reading me reading a story to her last night, she wanted to tell me a story about her centaur bathroom museum that she wants to create. It's a museum for bathrooms that are only for centaurs. And it's an open air bathroom, and there's a large pit, and then there's a tree that kind of arches over it, and one of the tree's branches is fake, and you pull on it, and it flushes the centaur toilet. So, yeah. I'm not making any of that up, I swear. Anyways, this one's called Blue Haze, Good Night Moon. And I had never read Good Night Moon until I had kids. I suffered as a child, I really did. Blue Haze, Good Night Moon. Black smoke courses along the blank hills. There is a crack that runs the length of it. Shouts in far off dusk, I park. The engine ticks. Early night heat, late September. Soon the leaves will collapse their canopies like so many umbrellas. Then the summer of fire will no longer burn my lungs or clot my eyes, those plumes stretching from the west. Upstairs, the kids are asleep. White noise, the shape of a running fan. Nightlight burning their room. Gold from within, a glistening cocoon. 10 o'clock. I tiptoe in, listen to their sleep, gaze at their shadow features. It is like drinking cold water from a well. All right. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for coming. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I really appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on December 12th, 2008.